All right, I think we're going to get started. Good morning. My name is Hope Hogan, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I'll be the hearing officer for today's hearings. We're here today for case number 24957, which is a motion of the Commission to consider adopting new rules and amendments to the general rules and regulations for the conservation of crude oil and natural gas, codified as Article 43-02 of the North Dakota Administrative Code. There's copies of the proposed rule amendments up on the table if anybody wants to have a copy. I don't know that we have enough for everybody, but there's a few available up there. This hearing, as well as the other hearings which the Commission held this week, will be streamed live via the internet and can be accessed at the Department of Mineral Resources Oil and Gas Division website. The Industrial Commission is required to adopt administrative rules in accordance with the North Dakota Century Code, Chapter 28-32. This rules hearing is held pursuant to North Dakota Century Code 28-32-11. The purpose of this hearing is to ensure the public has an opportunity to provide their comments and submit data, views, and arguments before administrative rules are adopted. It's important to the administrative rules process that the public's comments are received and considered. Anyone that believes that their ability to participate in this hearing is hampered by a disability of any kind, please let me know so that we can make arrangements so you can fully participate in this process. We'd ask that you keep in mind that this is an administrative rules hearing and not a legislative or court hearing. The purpose of the hearing is to get input from the public, especially those who have not yet had a chance to be heard concerning these rules, or those who have not or will not have an opportunity to submit written comments. This is not a question and answer session. The purpose of the hearing is not to pose questions to the Commission staff about the proposed rules, but instead it's an opportunity for Commission staff to receive input from the public. We'd ask that you try not to repeat testimony of others, but rather refer to previous testimony that you might agree with or disagree with. We have an attendance sheet that we're going to pass around. We'd ask that everybody sign in so that we can have a list for our record of all the parties that attended this hearing. Likewise, we have a sheet up on the table for anybody that intends to testify today. We're going to ask you to sign that as well so that we have that information for our record. Unfortunately, we cannot accept telephonic testimony today. And then probably the last thing, in order to make sure that the Commission staff understands everybody's testimony, they may ask you some questions following your testimony. So now I'm going to open the floor for testimony. Anybody that wishes to testify or provide comments, we'd ask that you come forward and sit to the microphone. And please provide us your name, address, and the organization you are representing, if any.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Representative Marvin Nelson from District 9. I'll be very brief with my testimony this morning. First, I find the definition of interested party to be needlessly narrow and believe such a rule would potentially have detrimental effects on the relationship between the government and the citizens of North Dakota. For instance, someone who relies on tourism might want to comment on something impacting an area that he or she does not own or manage. By not being able to even comment, resentment would build, and he would likely feel he wasn't really represented. I'm sure you've had lots of comments on that rule by now, so I won't go into further detail. But please I ask you to delete that change. It is a good step to require notification and mapping of the gathering lines before installation. There are, for instance, many landslide areas in western North Dakota, and it doesn't help anyone to put a pipeline into a landslide. The requirements of berms on pretty much all facilities is long overdue. We've had way too many spills needlessly escape the pad areas over the years. Containment of a much higher percentage of spills will improve landowner relations. And I would also comment that there seems to be some confusion among some of the oil operators who think that as long as there's not an oil sheen on top of the water in the pads, that they're free to pump it over the berm. And there needs to be an education on that they can't do that. The repeating of the North Dakota Century Code in the rules is in many cases needless and creates potential problems and confusions. For instance, a law is passed and goes into effect, but the rule which repeats the law will still be in the North Dakota Administrative Code until the rule is changed. It also adds to cost, since each change in the Century Code would result in changes in the Administrative Code. I would, for instance, point to the one where a landowner can, after 7 years of a temporary abandonment, can ask for a hearing. I don't believe it's necessary to have that also in the Administrative Code when it's in the Century Code. And if the law would change, then it takes better than a year to change the Administrative Code, and I just think it needlessly creates confusion and adds to costs of doing the rulemaking. That concludes my comments. Is there any questions?
Representative Nelson, as far as the TA reference goes, do you think it's necessary to mention under our Administrative Code where it talks about temporary abandonment that there is some reference in the statute, or just not mention it at all?
I don't think it's really necessary, because it's not like it's an enforcement action per se. The mentioning in the Century Code, it's not something that the inspectors are going to be writing up an infraction or anything like that. So I just don't really think it's necessary that, it maybe would be a little bit, but so many of the things that are in the Century Code are just repeated word for word in the Administrative Code, and I just find that needless.
Okay, thank you. And then as far as pumping over the top of the berm fluids, it's my understanding that before that is done, that the health department requires the operator to sample that water, and that's a process that they approve. Have you talked to the health department about that? Or
that would be required, but they have no field inspectors and no way to enforce it. And you can, for instance, go on Google Earth, and it's very common in the older wells to be able to see exactly where the guy pumps the water that has salt over the corner of the berm over a period of years. And so while it's against the law, there seems to end up being no real enforcement of it in the end.
Yeah. Thank you.
Did you want that
written? Thank you.
Yes,
yeah,
please.
If you.
We'll have Kevin stamp it in.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson, just clarification. So you testified in favor of the notification, the prior notification for underground gathering pipelines?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Do we have other parties wishing to testify?
Morning.
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 My name is Zeno Ferris, and I'm here today to testify on behalf of Enduro Operating LLC. We've been an operator since sometime in 2012, mostly through acquisitions. We acquired the Ward Williston Company to start off. And today we operate approximately 600 wells in North Dakota. And among those wells are 17 EOR units, water flood units, and each one of those and its associated infrastructure are bonded under separate bonds. So we strongly feel that an additional bond is not necessarily necessary for our EOR units. If it is necessary, then perhaps we should have a blanket bond for all units also, as opposed to 17 individual units. The total of our bonding right now is $1.8 million to the state of North Dakota. So we understand that the commission has the right to regulate pipeline bonds, but we would like maybe some thought about the fact that we already are bonded for those EOR units. Secondly, and a lot of the language, it seems to be kind of overreaching is not the correct term. It just seems to be kind of vague as to what is handled. I understand that perhaps maybe the saltwater handling facility is covered under our bonds as associated SWDs associated with our wells and associated with our units, but it's not really clear in the language. So what we're concerned about is somewhere down the road somebody could come back and say that we need to have additional bonds on our SWDs that we're using for our units. In addition, we would like the commission to consider some sort of different definition for flow lines and gathering systems. Without flow lines, without emulsion flow lines and injection flow lines in EOR units, essentially you don't have an EOR unit. And we would like for the commission to consider that as part of the unit bonding as opposed to a separate bond. As far as anything else goes, I think what we'll do is probably defer to the written comments at that point in time.
Are there any questions?
Zeno, are you suggesting that under 29.1, where we start defining underground pipelines, that we actually try to define what's a flow line or an injection line and
yes,
clear that as to whether those are regulated under this section and bonded under this section?
Yes, because I know in the proposed rule you have language that says it's not to meant the piping on the well pad. But of course in our EOR units we've got pump jacks essentially with flow lines to either test facilities or CTBs. And both of those, in both of those instances, it's not a specific gathering system with several properties going to a point. So we would like to somehow eliminate that from the pipeline gathering rule. I mean, basically, we go in with fiberglass for our emulsion lines and high pressure poly for our injection lines, and all of our field foremen and field personnel are well trained in repairing those and all that stuff. So that's basically what we're suggesting, is to make some sort of differentiation between a true gathering system and an EOR flow line system.
Okay, thank you.
Zeno, under our saltwater handling facilities rule 4302.03.53, it does state there that the saltwater handling facilities that are connected as an appurtenance to a well or treating plant would not be considered for separate bonding. So any facilities that you would have that are connected to the units would be an appurtenance to that unit and would not require additional bonding. Is that your understanding from reading the rules? Is that
yes, clear? And that's my understanding from also talking to people at the commission, that's the way they're going to apply the rule.
Okay.
But I just wanted to make sure that it was abundantly clear that's what that meant. And then likewise, to have some consistency with the term appurtenance, because in our view, our flow lines for emulsion and injection are an appurtenance to the EOR unit. And each one of those is bonded, regardless of the number of wells.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Do you have other parties that would like to testify?
Good morning, committee members. My name is Troy Coons, representing Northwest Landowners Association. We represent about 500 farm families and property owners in the state. First of all, I want to commend the committee members for the efforts that you've taken in this process. We're very happy with the steps you're taking. Wanted to set that as the precedence for our comments. I have just a one-page talk here to make it short. We will be introducing a lot more detailed information in the future after the public hearings are done. First thing I would like to address is the diking incapacity. With that, one thing I think that should be looked at is the highest annual daily rain capacity on some other type of storage facilities for fuel and such. That's one thing that has to be looked at, or they use 150% of the volume of the largest container and how the water would be handled. As Representative Nelson mentioned earlier, that's a concern. Next here, I'll just read our one-page handout to you here. And I know it's been talked about, so I'll make it short on the interested party. And we'll have a lot more detail on that coming. Interested party definition is unconstitutional and illegal. We have had private attorneys analyze the issue, and we feel submitting detailed comments in writing on why the definition is unconstitutional. The basic problem is the definition conflicts with court doctrine and constitutional rule. Next item that I'd like to deal with is the saltwater gathering facilities. And the definition we feel is too vague and broad. By defining them as sites, the definition covers any place used for handling, storage, disposal, or deleterious substance obtained or used in connection with oil and gas exploration and development. This is an unconstitutional because it can be read to cover oil fields, special waste facilities regulated by the North Dakota Health Department, and it is also concerning because such a broad definition by the NDIC may take power and jurisdiction away from local government, and we believe in local control. Next issue is bonding amounts are inadequate. Northwest Landowners Association commends NDIC for the new rules and bonding requirements. We do feel that the blanket bonding level of $100,000 is inadequate, and some of that is evident now in the downturn and the situation a lot of companies find themselves in, and to say nothing of the future with the expansion of the Bakken and where we may find ourselves at some point. So we like to see the $50,000 or higher per site instead of the blanket. Next topic would be reclamation. Northwest landowners would like the NDIC to revise its rules on surface reclamation while it's making these changes. Currently, the NDIC requires a site to be reclaimed as closely as practical to the original condition. It is common for pipeline easements and surface use agreements to include language requiring reclamation of cropland to pre-disturbance soil productivity measured by yields on adjacent undisturbed lands, and for pasture lands, native prairie, and hay land for the type and density of vegetation to be equal to that of adjacent undisturbed lands. This standard is simple recognition that the land should be restored to its pre-disturbed condition and not as close as reasonably practical. The standard NDIC uses should match the standards regularly required by landowners in pipeline easements and surface agreements. And with that, I think a person can use either the background around these sites, or you could have baseline data set up in advance before a site goes in, have cores taken, the data put in place, so in 30, 40, 60 years, we'll know what that should be instead of speculation. Next thing would be the NDIC should be commended for the new rule making design and construction standards along with third-party inspection. This is something Northwest Landowners Association has pushed for in the past. The other requirements for spill response, control, corrosion testing, and other additional requirements are very positive improvements. And these ideas have been supported by Northwest Landowners Association in the past. And Northwest Landowners Association continues to support these regulations and the diligent enforcement of these regulations. That's all. Any questions?
Troy, you talked about the diking, and the highest daily rain event. You want to expand upon that, or will you on your written comment?
On our written comment for today, out of respect, we wanted to come before you because we're very happy with the stances you're taking and the progress you're making. We're going to have that a lot more defined, but what we mean is, if you look at historical data, highest annual daily rainfall for that region should be included in the volume of that diking system and how that water would be dealt with. So if your tank holds 10,000 gallons and you say daily flow should be included in that, you should also consider the volume of rainfall that could be put into that situation for overflow.
Have you done any preliminary work to see how much of a, you know, how much of a substantial event that is?
Yes, but I did not bring that with. That will be in our written report.
Okay.
It is used in other type of facilities that hold, like diesel fuel and those type of requirements for storage facilities. It's something to consider. That, or they use a formula of 150% of the largest tank in that system. There's two different ways that we see it's been done.
And then on the bonding, you indicated that it was, the bonding was not adequate. Are you talking about the current bonding on oil wells that were not?
The $50,000 bonding for oil wells.
Okay.
And specifically towards the $100,000 blanket. You know, with the downturn now, we can see some of the problems that may come in the future. I think that'll be definitely inadequate to reclaim some of these in the future. And the size and scope of this will just grow. So we have a lot of concern there.
So you're concentrating on the well bonding,
yes,
not the pipeline and saltwater handling facility bonding?
Well, actually all of them. We're looking at all of them, but today I was speaking to the site.
Okay.
But in the written response, it will be to all of them.
And as far as the reclamation goes, you're talking about incorporating somehow requirements in our rules on what the pipeline agreements have in them. Would it be just a broad statement that would be made that they have to honor those pipeline agreements?
No, we're talking more that it should be set in the rule that the site or the pipeline areas needs to be back to pre-disturbance conditions, not as close as practical. You know, basically the pipeline or the site is a guest on the surface owner's property because of the right of ingress or eminent domain, so they should be made whole. So the best way to do that is use baseline or background information to make them whole.
Okay. And as far as our rules go, they would not preempt any agreement that the surface owner would make. So.
Correct. But that is not in all easements. There was a lot of easements done before all of this was put in place, and there's a bulk of them out there. And not everybody still does that. And so we're looking out for the long-term effects, you know, 20 years, 40 years from now, when the size and scope of this is a lot larger.
You also indicated that under interested party that it was unconstitutional. In your written statement, will you also cite,
yes,
you know, we have, put the cites in there?
We have case law. I've got some of that with today,
okay,
but for time, I thought I would just make it brief. I didn't want to dwell on the things that you said have been talked about in the past too much, so yes, you'll get a lot more in our written statement.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, do we have other parties that wish to testify?
Morning.
Good morning.
My name is Reese Oz. I'm with Cardinal in Williston. We represent various oil and gas operators and companies who are regulated by the NDIC. I'd like to start out by saying I agree with previous testimony that as currently drafted, language is ambiguous and needs to clearly define a saltwater handling facility. That leaves a lot of questions as currently drafted. I'd also like to add that I'm in favor of removing the requirement of obtaining a physical address from a county for oil and gas facilities. The counties are generally very overwhelmed, and in some cases it's taken us over a year to actually obtain the address after applying for it. I'd also like to add that current spill response requirements as currently drafted will also significantly add to the workload of overburdened county emergency managers. And in general, county employees don't have the engineering and scientific backgrounds needed to effectively regulate a spill response plan. So we would suggest removing that requirement as well.
Any questions?
Reed, you indicated that you're representing several companies. Is it a certain area? Is it Bottineau County operators? Or what are you talking about as far as representation?
We're regulatory consultants for companies operating generally in western North Dakota, eastern Montana.
Okay, and what's the full name of your company, Cardinal?
Cardinal Incorporated.
Oh, okay. I had Cardinal in my mind, so it's Cardinal. Okay.
Yes.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Reed, do you have anything specific about the saltwater handling facilities that I think you referenced earlier testimony, that things that are not clear enough? I know we heard the last couple of days some questions about what's commercial and what's non-commercial and those type of things. What is there something specific about the way that we're defining it here in 53 that you would suggest we clear up, or?
I guess, you know, along the lines of defining commercial versus non-commercial, but including, you know, central tank batteries, is that has salt water from various different wells coming into a central tank battery before being disposed of. Is that also going to be considered a saltwater handling facility?
Okay, so you'd like that to be clear whether it is or not.
Correct.
All right, thank you.
Reese, are you suggesting to completely strike the requirement for the spill response plan to be developed in conjunction with local emergency managers?
Yes.
And tailored to the specific risks of the localized area?
Just in conjunction with the local emergency managers. Like I said, they're already overburdened with a lot of work and generally don't have the engineering and scientific backgrounds required to effectively regulate a spill response plan.
Well, they would just be including the development of it. They wouldn't regulate it. We would regulate that. Okay.
Thank you. Do we have other parties wishing to testify?
It's just getting nice in here.
Yeah. Good morning, committee. My name is Alexis Brinkman-Baxley. I'm with the North Dakota Petroleum Council. Our address is 100 West Broadway, Suite 200, Bismarck. North Dakota Petroleum Council is a trade association that represents more than 475 companies involved in all aspects of the oil and gas industry. Our companies hail from North Dakota, South Dakota, and the Rocky Mountain region. So we do have extensive written comments that we'll submit at a later date. However, I just wanted to comment today specifically on subsection 430203-49, oil production equipment dikes and seals. As written, the proposed changes in this section expand the authority of the director to require dikes and appear to require new dikes on any existing wells and tanks at any production facility built or rebuilt on or after July 1st, 2000. The director already has the authority to require dikes and berms when deemed necessary. Conditional usage of dikes and berms has become common practice over the past several years and is supported by industry where appropriate and effective. This process has been used wisely and effectively thus far. The expanded requirements would greatly increase costs to operators and at current prices would likely result in a large number of wells being plugged and abandoned. The cost of building a berm on each pad would range from $12,000 to $30,000 per pad on new wells plus maintenance costs. Operators would also incur the additional expense of dealing with stormwater captured on site, which could exceed $35,000 per year per company. We don't believe the intent of this rule was to apply to existing wells or be retroactively applied, but that's not clear, and we would recommend that language be adjusted to clarify. NEPC believes the current policy of requiring berms only when necessary has been effective, and statistics show that that policy is working. As such, we suggest the requirement for full site berms be struck. The commission has expressed concerns that the rate of uncontained spills is increasing at a troubling rate, but we believe the data shows that the containment rate only appears to have decreased 1 or 2% between 2014 and 2015, and no more than 5% since 2013. The containment rate has varied from about 70 to 80% in the last decade, even as wells in production have increased dramatically, and recent years are well within that range. In addition, of the approximately 25% of uncontained spills, 1/4 of those are attributed to pipeline leaks, which would almost always occur off-site. It seems illogical to include that pipeline leaks in containment statistics. Additionally, the statistics do not clearly indicate most of the spills would be contained by berms. Many of the spills being deemed uncontained are the result of things like vapor release or a blowout, where the uncontained fluid is carried off-site by the wind and would not be contained by a berm. It's clear to see that adding perimeter berms would only affect an incredibly small number of spills and leaks. The cost-to-benefit ratio in this situation is incredibly disproportionate. In addition, the use of berms can cause a number of unintended consequences that need to be considered. Federal agencies typically don't use berms due to the unavoidable accumulation of runoff stormwater. The accumulation can result in standing pools of water and mud, which create safety risks of their own and are expensive to collect and dispose of. The use of perimeter berms can also limit an operator's ability to lessen its footprint and leave more land for agricultural or other uses by reclaiming unused portions of an active well pad. I think a couple of examples, you know, if you think of a ranch, your hay yard or your feedlot, if you were to build a full perimeter, full site berm on those facilities and you have a large number of stormwater, you're creating a environmental safety risk of its own there. And I think that's important to consider. We don't necessarily object to berms around your tanks, your heater treaters, those types of things we think can be effective. But we really need to consider the side effects when you would do a full site berm. We have a number of companies that will build their well pad, and once the wells are completed on that pad, we'll reclaim portions of the pad so that more land can be put back into agricultural production or other uses, which we think is a fantastic way to reduce our footprint. But if you're requiring a site berm on that full pad, that can't happen. They're not going to go back and be able to rebuild that berm to reclaim a portion of that pad. So I think the main thing to consider here is truly that cost to benefit ratio. If you are adding an increased cost, but the dike or the berm truly won't contain that many more spills, and anecdotally from our companies, the statistics show that a very, very small percentage would then be contained by a berm. You might be causing more issues than you're fixing. Additionally, if a company needs to deal with that accumulated stormwater and clean that up, you're adding trucks. Trucks are going to come in and pump that water out and haul it off. So now you've had likely a big moisture event. We're trying to get trucks off the road as it is, and we're just putting more back on as they're pumping and hauling that wastewater off. So we don't believe that site berms would truly be effective in the way that the commission would hope they'd be effective, and we would hope that you would consider those aspects when taking a look at this proposed rule.
Are there any questions from the staff?
Alexis, the cost that you gave us for constructing a berm, the $12,000 to $30,000, does that include diking around the tanks and, in addition, a perimeter berm?
It was just a perimeter berm.
Okay. And is that cost the cost of doing it twice, since you indicated that you would have to reduce the site at another time and rebuild that berm? Does that include that cost?
No, the cost would include doing it once. I guess what my statement intended to convey was that in certain situations we have companies who will reduce their site currently, under the current rules, without a berm because they're not using that land, allowing it to go back into agricultural production. If we were to put a site berm on, that would not happen. Not that they were rebuilding the berm, just that if they were to be required to build a berm around all sites.
And I didn't catch your, I thought you said there would be a $30,000 annual cost.
So in polling our companies and crafting our comments, we put together a technical committee of 10 to 15 companies operating in North Dakota. And polling those companies, their engineering and technical staff estimated approximately a cost of $30,000 per year just to maintain and deal with that wastewater and runoff.
And that is that cost per company, or is that cost
per company per year?
Okay. And was anything taken into consideration on preventative work, like constructing the perimeter berm that would possibly stop any runoff and future remediation that would have to be done? You know, did you look at the preventative aspects of it?
You know, we certainly did, and we think in certain situations, as the rules stand now, where whether it is a extremely environmentally sensitive area, different situations where site berms might be required has been effective. Sometimes it is effective, and it would be prudent. We just don't believe that it should be blanket applied to all sites. We did have some discussion on different sloping and grading measures that people have used to kind of control some of that runoff that might be worth looking at as well.
Thank you.
Alexis, you mentioned a cost to benefit ratio. Did Strong Council perform a cost to benefit ratio? Are there?
Well, based on the statistics that we have from our companies, the less than 2 to 3% now, anecdotal statistics from our companies, because spill statistics, as you know, have been tough to interpret. The small percentage that would have been contained by a berm, based on that $12,000 to $30,000 per cost per well, plus $30,000 annually in maintenance, we believe that cost to benefit ratio is not there.
So did you calculate the benefit the cost of reclaiming a spill that got off site? Was that included in that cost to benefit ratio?
We did not perform a full cost to benefit ratio, but understanding that the small number of spills that we would be reclaiming, you know, the company is responsible for those monetary costs, as you know, we still felt that the costs would be, or the benefits and costs would, right word here, the cost for placing those berms on all sites would simply not measure up and would not prevent enough spills to be worth it. We feel that not enough would be prevented that way. As we stated in our comments, a number of those uncontained spills are things from vapor release, blowout, fluids being carried by the wind that we will still be reclaiming, and a berm isn't going to prevent or help.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to testify or provide comments? All right, pursuant to North Dakota Century Code Section 28-32-12, the Commission will have a written comment period during which data, views, or arguments concerning the proposed rules or feedback regarding today's testimony or any testimony received this week will be accepted by the Commission and made part of our rulemaking record. All comments received by the Commission both today and during the written comment period will be given serious consideration by the Commission. All comments and correspondence must be received by the Commission prior to 5 p.m. on Monday, April 25th, 2016, and it will be made part of our record for this case, as will comments which were received prior to today's hearing. Any comments received after 5 p.m. on Monday, April 25th, 2016 will not be included by the record and be included in the record and cannot be considered by the commission. So that will conclude our hearing for today. Thank you for everybody that attended.
Thank you.